Welcome back to another episode here on the Burrowshire Podcast. I'm Brandon Vaught, and I'm joined by my best friend, Father Blake Britton. Today, we are going to talk about one of our favorite men and one of our favorite books, that is J.R.R. Tolkien and his great epic, Lord of the Rings. Father Blake, this has been a long time coming. I'm glad we're finally going to have an episode to discuss it.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess the G.K. Chesterton Benedict episode was preparatory. They paved the way for the Lord of the Rings episode. So I'm excited that we had these two back to back.
I was looking at the intro video bumper for our podcast, and real quickly it flashes images of Benedict and Chesterton, but then there's Tolkien smoking a pipe and there's Gandalf. And so I think with this episode, we will have talked about all those major influences that lead off the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, let's talk about Lord of the Rings. Here's how I'm hoping this episode will go. So first, maybe we'll talk a little bit about the book itself, our own experience with the book. Then we're going to give some background on Tolkien and his Catholicism, because the special emphasis of this episode is on Catholic themes in the Lord of the Rings. And spoiler alert, J.R.R. Tolkien admitted, we'll come to this quote in a little bit, that The Lord of the Rings is, of course, a fundamentally religious and Catholic work. Those are his words, Tolkien's words. So the first half, we'll talk about Tolkien, his Catholicism. And then the second half, we'll go into the books themselves, highlighting specific Catholic themes. So before we get to that second half, I'm going to issue another spoiler warning. So if you haven't read the book, just close this podcast and go read the book first. That's way more important than anything that you'll hear us say. But I will give a fair warning about halfway through, where we'll cover some spoiler parts of the narrative. So even if you haven't read it, you can still enjoy the first half of this discussion. So let's start with this, Father Blake. Talk to me about when you first discovered Lord of the Rings, your history reading it. I know you're a big Tolkien fan like I am. So give us a little bit of background on you and Tolkien and the book.
Oh, goodness. Well, they say that Thomas Aquinas came out the womb, you know, declaring the said contra. And I came out the womb just opening up the first lines of The Hobbit, you know. And at the end, there was this green door. But my first exposure was actually mandatory exposure, I guess you could say, because I was required to read The Hobbit in school, in my Catholic school, St. Thomas Aquinas. And so I really didn't know too much about Tolkien before that. And I was in fourth or fifth grade at the time when we were assigned the reading. So I went through it. I really didn't enjoy it too much initially. And I think it's just because I had to develop still this reading spirit within me. But that was my first exposure to Tolkien. The next time that I'd really be exposed to The Lord of the Rings was, of course, when those wonderful movies came out. And I watched all of them, and I was amazed. And then, of course, I learned that they're rooted in this book, and that's what led me to read the books, which were even more amazing than the movies. And by that point, I was already in my teenage years, 13, 14, and my vocation was starting to solidify in my heart as well to the priesthood. So I was able to detect these Catholic themes within Lord of the Rings immediately, as soon as I started reading through it, without even knowing Tolkien's background as far as his Catholicism. When I started reading through them, saying, oh my goodness, these are such profound Catholic elements. These are inspirations of heroism, of sacrifice, of prophecy, of this sort of priestly character also, which I saw in Gandalf mostly, in sort of relation to him. And he still remains one of my literary role models. I love how Gandalf is such a selfless, sacrificial man. I think he's a very priestly character, although I know there's other themes of priesthood throughout Lord of the Rings as well and other characters. But that was my initial exposure to the Lord of the Rings. And Tolkien has become a staple in my literature ever since. I mean, I read him regularly, especially some of his nonfiction works. I really enjoy his essay on fairy stories. I think it's a delightful essay, and also one that is very necessary to recultivate authentic imagination and authentic artistry within our world. And also his other works that he wrote outside Lord of the Rings. There are multiple other fiction or nonfiction works that he wrote that are just superb. And I came to eventually appreciate him as not just the author of one of the great epics of English literature, but as an English writer, period. His ability to put together prose in such an entrancing way really was stunning to me. And I use him as a model in many ways in my own writing and how I speak.
Yeah, my history very much parallels yours. I think my mom bought me a set of the Lord of the Rings books when I was in high school, but I just never read them. And then the movies came out. And like you, I went to go see all of the movies, was entranced by Peter Jackson's work. I think it's one of actually the very few cases where the movies pretty much do as good as the books. There's some misgivings here and there. Maybe we'll talk about them as we go along, but he did a phenomenal job with the Lord of the Rings movies. So I saw those movies and then went back to my bookshelf and realized I had the books. And so I started picking them up, reading them, fell in love with them. This was long before Catholicism was on my radar. And so I, like many people, read Lord of the Rings first and then later began to unpack these Catholic themes. And I had an experience I think a lot of people do that go take that route where it's Tolkien first, Catholicism later. They realize that Tolkien laid the groundwork for this sacramental imagination that once you encountered the real thing in Catholicism, you were much more available to it. You were much more drawn to it because you had already fallen in love with it through Tolkien's work. So he had that sort of sacramental, enchanting effect on my mind. And then, man, ever since then, I just haven't stopped reading. I've read Lord of the Rings several times, pretty much all the rest of his fiction and nonfiction. I remember reading an interview with a lady. She was asked, "How many times have you read Lord of the Rings?" And she just said, "Well, you never really stop reading Lord of the Rings." She said, "As soon as I get to the end,
It's true.
I go back to the beginning." And that's how it's been for me.
It's true.
I read all of my heavy fiction, or I should say longer fiction, like books that are more than 500 pages on my Kindle, just because I don't like carrying around the real thick books. And on the Kindle home screen, it has the three latest books you've read, so you can get right back into them. And Lord of the Rings, I think, for the last 8 years has always been one of those three. So I'll read like another book, but I'm always going back into the Lord of the Rings. So it's my favorite book. Tolkien's my favorite fiction writer. So I think you and I both share that in common.
Yeah, and it taps into, of course, for you and I in particular, that love of battle and the sort of Norse mythology, which I know we'll speak about later in the podcast. And that's just something else that many people don't realize is that Tolkien is actually the one who revives this entire field of fiction and fantasy novelship, and actually not only revives it, but brings it into a whole new genre, and a whole new way of writing. All those who came after him are really trying to be him, actually. And he really did something quite revolutionary in penning the Lord of the Rings.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the book itself, Tolkien the Catholic, and then we'll get into the specific Catholic theme. So I just wanted to mention a couple facts that when I first heard them were a little surprising, but also encouraging as a lifelong Tolkien lover. So one of them is that at the end of the last millennium, so it was near in the year 2000, the BBC ran a poll throughout the United Kingdom asking what was the best book of the century. And with a landslide, Lord of the Rings won the day. And it was to the chagrin of many of the literary commenters and journalists who didn't really like Lord of the Rings, in part because it was so popular. It was so beloved by the common man that, their high taste had no room for it. So they ran another poll, and once again, Lord of the Rings popped up at the top. They did a similar poll in the United States. I got to find the source for this. I'm just quoting it from memory. Lord of the Rings wasn't number one, but it was like number two or number three. So almost every poll that's been ran over the past few years of the best books over the past millennium, best books of the past century, Lord of the Rings is always near the top. Here's a review of the Lord of the Rings. I want to quote this. It's about a paragraph long, from C.S. Lewis. So remember, C.S. Lewis was the great friend of J.R.R. Tolkien. They were part of the Inklings group. And when the first volume of The Lord of the Rings came out, The Fellowship of the Ring, here was C.S. Lewis's review in a local paper. He said, "This book is like lightning from a clear sky. A reviewer need say little, except that here are beauties which pierce like swords or burn like cold iron. Here is a book that will break your heart. They will know that it is good news, good beyond hope. To complete their happiness, one need only add that it promises to be gloriously long." Lewis said the book was so good that he was happy that it was so long. It's over 1,000 pages. And then he concludes saying, "As we read, we find ourselves sharing their burden," there being the characters of the fellowship, And when we have finished the book, we return to our own life, not relaxed, but fortified. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to quote that line because to me, that's one of the best qualities of this book, is that you finish this long epic, you close it, and you don't just think, man, that was a good story. I had a lot of entertainment out of that. I really enjoyed that. You close that book and the world around you, you now see in a different way. You're now fortified with new virtues and a new sacramental view of the world that you didn't have before reading that book. So unlike almost any other book I've read, this book has shaped reality for me. It shaped the way I see the world beyond the book. And for that reason, I think it is deservedly considered one of, if not the best book of the past 100 years.
Yeah. And that's how you know it's rooted in something transcendental. It's not just a fantastical work from someone's imagination, but it taps into eternal truths which fortify the human heart. As a spiritual director, what I'll do with some of my spiritual directees, or even with those that I help in confession and counseling, is I ask them to find some form of literature or maybe even a scene in a movie that really talks to the depths of their soul. Hmm. And anytime that they find themselves getting lackadaisical in their spiritual life, or they find themselves in this sort of pit of sadness or this depression, if you will, in the spiritual life, to go ahead and turn on that scene in the movie or open up that chapter of the book. Hmm. And just let those characters inspire you. And that could rekindle that initial virtue that you had when you followed Christ. I do that regularly with Lord of the Rings. When I find myself in spiritual direction, or I find myself exhausted as a priest and all the things I'm working, I just read Gandalf talking to Frodo in the caves, you know, the Mines of Moria, those beautiful lines. That's probably one of my favorite interactions in all of the books. Or I read through Frodo and Sam going up Mount Mordor, and just my heart is inspired to say, I can climb the mountain of holiness. They made it to the end. Or I can be that wise sage figure that's patient with those who are still trying to seek and understand, like Gandalf was with Frodo. So you see in there an inspiration for your own spiritual life as well.
I'm trying to think what I would say if you asked me that question, because I'm a little worried that in the context of spiritual direction, I'd say, you know, the scene that really speaks to my heart is the Battle of Helm's Deep, where Aragorn is just slaying millions of orcs. And then you'll be challenged to come up with some spiritual lesson from that fact.
And you know I would, some way or shape or form, after I pulled up on my iPhone and say, let's watch it together real quick.
Let's watch it a few times together.
Yeah. Well, perhaps if we watch the movie together, we could find the reason why this speaks to you.
Actually, on that note, I should interject here as a true Tolkien fan. If you're going to watch the movies, watch the extended editions. That's dividing line between the amateurs and the real Tolkien enthusiasts. So set aside 4.5 hours for each one of the films, you know, 15 hours for all three of them together, and enjoy the extended editions. Now in 4K, they just redid them and remastered them in 4K.
I hold as a badge of honor, and I will say it now to the world through this podcast. When I was in college, I made the Lord of the Rings extended marathon. I did it, guys. I watched all three extended editions in the one day. I don't know how many pizzas I ate in that day, nor do I know how many brain cells and heart cells I killed me eating all those pizzas and watch all those movies. But I am proud to say that I did it once in my life. So.
I feel like there should be
Hope my bishop isn't watching this podcast. what's
that called when you go on a special pilgrimage and you receive an indulgence or like a plenary indulgence?
Yes.
Yeah, there should be like a Lord of the Rings extended marathon plenary indulgence.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you might be dead at the end of it. So you'll need that indulgence. But no, I mean, I agree. I think this is something that's very important for us to bring up in pastoral formation. So we'll have to see.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the Catholicism of the Lord of the Rings. Again, we'll get in a moment here into specific scenes and characters. But overall, let me read you a quote from one of J.R.R. Tolkien's letters. He's got a beautiful collection of letters in which he answers questions about his own work, but he also, there's letters in there that he wrote to his children when they were young, when they were old, a lot of beautiful advice as a father. He comments on Catholicism a lot, talks about marriage, talks about the Eucharist. So I encourage people, if you've read the Lord of the Rings books, pick up his collection of letters. They're quite beautiful. But here's one of them. Here's what he says. The Lord of the Rings is, of course, this is of course, as if it's obvious. The Lord of the Rings is, of course, a fundamentally religious and Catholic work, unconsciously so at first, but consciously in the revision. This is why I have not put in or have cut out practically all references to anything like religion, to cults or practices in the imaginary world. For the religious element is absorbed into the story and symbolism. Talk about that quote, Father Blake.
Yeah. I'm often emailed or asked by people, especially in the video game industry as well as in the movie industry, Father Blake, what can I do as a practicing Catholic in this industry to influence it for the good? And in many of their minds, the idea is, for example, in the video game industry, they're like, let's make a Catholic video game, meaning it's a Bible video game, you know, where we have Bible stories and stuff, or let's make it about one of the lives of the saints, or it's the same thing in the movie industry. Let's make a movie about one of the lives of the saints. That's how I'm going to influence the Catholic industry. It's not to say that those are bad ideas or bad things, but they're not fundamentally Catholic things. What it means to be Catholic, what it means to have a Catholic imagination, is to have this realm of fantasy and imagination that reflects the deeper goods without even necessarily explicitly alluding or referring to them. There are many ways to say Jesus without saying Jesus. There are many ways to talk about the cross without ever mentioning the cross. And Tolkien does that throughout Lord of the Rings constantly. You see that because he builds upon this foundational encounter that he has had with Catholicism, and which he has now taken to his heart, and over years and years it's matured through prayer, through contemplation, through Eucharistic adoration. Now it overflows out of him in this fantastic mythological way, but that is still shot through with these amazing transcendental truths. And that's what makes something essentially Catholic. And that's the genius, by the way, that evangelized much of Europe. Think of something like Beowulf. Beowulf, which is it is my favorite epic poem of all time. Brandon knows this. I read Beowulf multiple times a year. I go through it regularly, sort of like how you do with Lord of the Rings. Beowulf, fantastic epic poem of this Norse background, of this Anglo-Saxon mythology. And what do the monks do? They take this poem. They then use this character as a role model for young Anglo-Saxons of Christian virtue. See, they didn't just go and write an explicitly Christian story. They rather take this kind of mythological, fantastic background and they shoot it through with these basically Catholic virtues and that inspires people to reflect on them. So the same thing is done by Tolkien. Even though he doesn't mention Christ, even though he doesn't mention the virtues, every single character has this kind of ambiance about them and you see it refined inside of them. So this is something very important for us to appreciate, because a lot of times we think Tolkien's work is grand just because he, of his own power, was just a wonderful writer, or he somehow just had a great imagination. And both those things are true. But do not doubt that the reason why his work is so attractive to so many hundreds of millions of people for the past decades is because it has Catholicism at its root. And that is the truth that every human soul is longing for.
Yeah, Lord of the Rings is not just a book by a Catholic author. It is emphatically a Catholic book. That's what Tolkien is saying himself. It's fundamentally religious and a Catholic work. But I think people sometimes get confused when they come to it, because as Tolkien suggests in the quote I just read, there's no mention of God, prayer, no church, no religion, no worship, no liturgical sacrifice. And so they think, you know, how could this book be Catholic? But you have to understand that what Tolkien was aiming at was not to produce allegory. In fact, he was adamantly against allegory. So allegory is where certain figures or things in the story represent or stand for other things in our world. So a great example of this is the fiction series by his good friend C.S. Lewis, The Chronicles of Narnia. The Narnian Chronicles were much more like allegory. Some people will dispute that, but they were much more allegorical, where you have a figure like Aslan, the lion, who clearly is meant to be an allegorical representation of Christ. And you don't really find that in Lord of the Rings, where there's like an easy one-to-one allegorical comparison between a figure and some religious, you know, figure, religious symbolism. But what Tolkien was trying to do was not present like an easy religious apologetic. He wanted to imbue the entire Catholic sacramental worldview into Middle Earth, into this huge creation, this huge legendary myth that he wove together, not so that any particular instance could be directly correlated to a Catholic saint or a deity or a sacrament, but so that the whole thing brought the entire Catholic worldview into people's minds and hearts. So I think that's a key distinction. It's not an allegory, which is why it's not immediately evident as religious and Catholic. But as Tolkien says, that's the foundation of the whole thing. It's fundamentally religious and Catholic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Before we get to the themes here, one more thing I wanted to talk about is Tolkien's personal Catholicism. Many readers don't know that Tolkien was a devout Catholic, a devoted mass goer. In fact, two summers ago, Father Blake and I went to Oxford together, and we not only got to visit Tolkien's home parish, I believe it's St. Augustine's parish there in Oxford, but Father Blake got to celebrate mass. And then we spent time with the pastor there, Father John Sayward, one of my favorite spiritual writers. Mm-hmm. And he alerted us after the mass that during the mass, sitting in the front pew was Tolkien's daughter, Priscilla Tolkien. So we got to share mass with Tolkien's daughter, and Father Blake celebrated mass there. I know that's still one of the highlights of both of our lives.
Oh, it was incredible. And it's funny because at one point I eyed the elderly woman sitting there in the front row, and she was quite pious. I mean, in a very beautiful way, she was a woman of deep prayer, and I was impressed by that. Little did I know I was consecrating the Eucharist for Priscilla Tolkien, you know? And it was just such a powerful and inspirational moment to hear from the pastor that that's who that was, and to see that she has been going to daily mass there for decades, just like her father taught her. And her father very much was a Eucharistic man, a man deeply rooted in the tradition of the sacrifice, the Holy Mass and the other sacraments. And you could see that he instilled that upon his children so much so that one of his sons became a Catholic priest. And then, of course, his other children maintained their practice of the Catholic faith.
Yeah, I remember we stayed afterward to pray there for a while in the church. And then I think later during our England trip, we came back to that church to pray even more. Yeah. And I remember contemplating there, looking at this beautiful altar, and they still remember Tolkien sitting, I think it was either the first pew or the second pew or whatever. I remember thinking, there sat the man who created this whole, you know, Middle Earth legendarium, but it all came from this place. He would sit here looking at the beauty of the Blessed Sacrament, and it was that beauty that permeated his whole world. In fact, here's one more quote I want to read. This is from one of his letters. I think this one was to his son. But he's speaking about the Eucharist. Here's what he says. Out of the darkness of my life, so much frustrated, I put before you the one great thing to love on earth, the Blessed Sacrament. There you will find romance, glory, honor, fidelity, and the true way of all your loves on earth. And more than that, death. I remember the first time I read that quote thinking, all of those things are what shine through in the Lord of the Rings. Yes. Romance, glory, honor, fidelity, death, and the beauty of death, the beauty of mortality. But Tolkien here saying, I got all that from the Blessed Sacrament.
Yes.
And so that church we were in was sort of the seedbed of the entire legendarium.
And there you see the catechetical and the formational nature of the Holy Eucharist, that in observing what Christ has done for us, it informs our own character. So as Tolkien, day after day, starting in his boyhood, because he's partially raised by a priest, but also then leading into his adulthood, day after day, he's witnessing the sacrifice of the liturgy. He's watching something seemingly normal and mundane become divine and transcendental, bread and wine, through this interlocutor, this interactor, if you will, who is the priest. And do not hesitate to believe that that influenced his writings of Lord of the Rings, and him taking something that was seemingly mundane, him taking a world, if you will, and imbuing it with this kind of genius, imbuing it with this kind of everlasting life, this unbelievable virtue. Well, that's what happens to bread and wine every time that we consecrate the Holy Eucharist. He becomes the infinitely loving God in our midst. So that was very catechetical and formational for Tolkien, most certainly.
All right. So that's a good deal of background. I think now we can move into part two of our conversation here, where I want to spend time looking at specific Catholic themes in Lord of the Rings. So here's where I'm going to give you the spoiler warning. If you haven't yet read the books, maybe now's a good time to pause this show, come back in 3 or 4 months after you've read the books, and listen to the rest of it.
We'll see you in
2 years. Yeah. but even if you haven't, maybe you want to continue listening, and we'll try not to reveal too much, but we'll naturally have to cover some of the plot lines. Okay, so specific Catholic themes. So you and I kind of jotted down some notes. They're not really in any particular order, so this will kind of just be a conversation. Just like, in fact, you and I have had this conversation where
this
we kind of just range over Lord of the Rings and the various themes. So that's what this is going to be. So I'd like to start off with I'd like to start off with the book before Lord of the Rings in terms of chronology, which is his magnum opus, The Silmarillion. So very quick background on, did you want to say something?
If you've read that, by the way, you are truly worthy of this podcast. if you have read The Silmarillion, I mean, I have, I know you have as well, Brandon. That is actually the real like denominator as far as are you a Tolkien fan or not.
Yeah. It took me quite a while to slog through it. It's dense and it's not the same style as The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. It's more episodic. So it's sharing little episodes about if you want to put it in biblical terms, the salvation history of Middle Earth. You get the first age, second age, leading up to the third age. But it's a very long and dense book. Anyway, Tolkien, who was a philologist, so that was his professional specialty. He was a master of languages, and he came up with these various languages, the Elven language and then a few others. And then he created a fictional set of people who could speak these languages, and then from there created a land on which these people could live, and then from there created a history of this land and this people. So the seed of a language kind of spun into this grand epic that is now known as the Legendarium. I've used that term a few times. That sort of means the whole thing that Tolkien created, this whole mythic scope. But it all begins and is rooted in the Silmarillion. That was the book Tolkien was most proud of, and he was most desperate to share with the world. Unfortunately, it didn't get published in his lifetime for a couple reasons. One, the publisher didn't think it would get that much demand, which was probably true. But second, Tolkien just would never finish it. He was a known niggler, so he kept adding and changing and he just would never bring it to a close. So it was only after his death that his son Christopher pulled it all together and to the book that we have now called The Silmarillion. So anyway, that's the background of The Silmarillion. At the very beginning of The Silmarillion, it offers a creation story, much like you'll find in the first few chapters of the book of Genesis. And at the risk of sounding blasphemous, I'll say Tolkien's creation story is at least as beautiful, if not more beautifully told, than what you'll find in Genesis. And here's why. The god figure in the Silmarillion, named Eru, also known as Ilúvatar, he brings the world into being through music, through songs. So he first creates these angelic beings known as the Ainur, and then he gives each of them vocal themes to sing. So they're each singing their own parts in this great chorus. And Tolkien explains that the music wasn't written down or given to them, but it was kindled within them like a secret fire by the flame imperishable. And if you recognize those words, that's because they're the very words that Gandalf speaks later on in The Lord of the Rings. He's one of these Ainur, these angelic beings. So the Ainur start singing this song, and through singing it, they hear and they learn more about themselves and more about Ilúvatar. But then one of these angelic beings, these Ainur, named Melkor, who was the most gifted and also the most rebellious of them all, begins to sing his own theme. Tolkien describes it as saying it was loud and vain and endlessly repeated, and it had little harmony, but rather a clamorous union as of many trumpets braying upon a few notes. But Ilúvatar takes that disharmonious melody from Melkor and weaves it in to the song that he's singing. So he takes this sinful, evil desire and weaves it into his good plans. But Melkor keeps trying to drown out the music of Ilúvatar. But every time he does, his most triumphant notes are then rewoven back into Iluvatar's own. Of course, obviously, if you're reading this through a biblical lens, you recognize Melkor is analogous to Satan, the fallen angel who wants to implement his own will and to be a master over other wills. So Melkor splits from the other angels. He's a fallen angel, and he wants to make war against them and their labors and eventually all of Middle Earth. And one of Melkor's lieutenants, or you know, second in command, ends up being Sauron. Sauron is the main villain throughout The Lord of the Rings. So that was a very brief recap, but only to emphasize that from the very beginning of Tolkien's Legendarium, he has the Catholic sacramental vision in his mind. You can't read that and not think of the Judeo-Christian creation story, that that world was created in a similar way to our world, that that God is similar to our God. And the main reason I want to emphasize this here is because in the Lord of the Rings books, you will not find, I don't think, any mentions, maybe someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think there's any mentions of Eru or Iluvatar is his other name in Middle Earth. So there's no mention of the God figure. He's kind of introduced in the Silmarillion, but he's always in the background in Lord of the Rings. He's not operating explicitly. That's, I think, a major key to understanding the Catholicism of Lord of the Rings, is that there was a God at the beginning of the myth and throughout Lord of the Rings, that even if you don't see him in Lord of the Rings, he's still ever present from the beginning.
Yeah, and this creation narrative is indicative of Tolkien's style of Catholicism throughout all of Lord of the Rings, insofar as the foundations of his mythology are very Catholic foundations in their principle. Let me give you an example. Notice how Melkor is not in and of himself a power, but rather he is the perversion of a power that's been given to him. So you have Iluvatar, who is actually the source of all being, but Melkor is not antithetical to Iluvatar in the sense of he's equal with him in evil. That would be like dualism. Rather, he's the taking of something good and the perversion of it, which is actually what evil is. We know that as Catholics, there is no such thing as essential evil. There's rather only good that's been twisted that's called evil, the perversion of the good, as St. Augustine will call it. Well, Melkor does the same thing. Melkor takes this goodness, which is the melody of Iluvatar, and he now turns it into a perverted evil. He now twists this hymn that's supposed to be harmonious and makes it into a cacophony. He makes it into something that's antithetical to the melody and to the hymn of God, of Iluvatar, and all the other angels who are working with him. So there's something very foundationally Catholic about that, and you'll see this as a presupposition throughout the rest of his work. Think most importantly where you see this is with Smeagol. Smeagol is good in the very depths of his being, but the ring over centuries slowly warps and twists him in. And Peter Jackson did a great job with illustrating this in the movie, how when Smeagol is going to back to his good essential roots, he's actually standing more upright. He can get on his hind legs a little bit more than usual. But when he's in his golem standpoint, he's literally on all fours like an animal. He's been crippled over. So it's not that Smeagol or Golem is evil in and of themselves, but they're a good that's been slowly deteriorated, that's been slowly turned in on itself in this kind of perversion.
Yeah, that's a critical point. Compare Lord of the Rings with a film series like Star Wars. Star Wars is very dualistic. You know, you have the Force, but then you have the good side and the dark side. You have good and evil that are sort of these equal and opposite forces that are fighting against each other throughout the whole series. But that's not Tolkien's vision. The Tolkien vision and the Catholic vision is that good is primordial and evil is derivative from the good. So evil is just some privation or some corruption of the good. You mentioned Gollum already. Gollum is a hobbit. He's a withered hobbit. He doesn't look anything like the hobbits, but he started off like a hobbit. In fact, I think it's at the beginning of the third film where it shows how he discovered the ring, and he is a hobbit, and then it was only after greed and lust for the ring over many, many years that he becomes this withered Gollum. We also discovered that the trolls are bred in mockery of the Ents. So the Ents are these tall tree-like creatures. The trolls are evil warpings of the Ents. The orcs are evil warpings of the elves. The Nazgul or the Black Riders are evil warpings of human kings. And so that's a very important point Tolkien wants to make, is that evil can't create anything of its own. As you said, Father Blake, there's nothing that's just essentially evil that can give rise to evil. Even Satan isn't completely evil, because he exists and being is good. Anything that exists has some measure of goodness. And so Tolkien gets that from his Catholic metaphysics, that evil is a corruption of the good, a warping of the good, and not something essential in itself.
Absolutely. And this is what makes, for example, Smeagol Golem one of the most beloved characters. I found that fascinating. If you look upon statistics of favorite characters in Lord of the Rings, Smeagol Golem is always near the top. And I think because we see a little bit of ourselves in Smeagol Golem. When we look at him, we see what happens to us whenever we sin. that we have this goodness and we really are trying. We're trying to get over our addictions. We're trying to get over our struggles. We're trying to be good, but there's something within us that keeps twisting in on itself, and we can sympathize, we can empathize with the struggle that Smeagol Golem's going through. But that's because he's an incredibly Catholic character, and he really shows through that Catholic drama of trying to triumph over sinfulness.
Let's talk a little bit about the ring, because the ring is what does this warping, especially in the case of Smeagol Gollum. That's one of my favorite depictions in The Lord of the Rings, is the effect that the ring has on people's identity and their sense of reality. So
is this the point of the podcast where I recite from memory in black tongue,
please,
the inscription around the ring?
Oh, please.
And then you come back like Gandalf and say, you cannot utter, or excuse me, not like Elrond, Lord Elrond, and say, you know, you cannot utter that speech in this land of Rivendell.
Do you know it? Do you want to say it?
Go ahead. No, don't worry about it.
Okay. Anyway, the ring, so all of these rings were created, but there's one ring to rule them all, one ring to bind them.
Right.
But this ring, when you put it on, you turn invisible and you have a massive amount of power. You're able to control nature. You're able to control other creatures. So that's why it's naturally attractive to most characters, even the good characters. They think, you know, the kings of the stewards of Gondor think, you know, if we can only get this ring, then we can defeat Sauron, because we'll use it for good. That's always the excuse, and the justification is, you know, if we get the ring, we won't be corrupted by it. We'll use it for good. But what everyone realizes once they acquire the ring or put the ring on is how it slowly starts warping your soul. You think that you're gaining power, but in reality, you're being brought under a power. You're being controlled by Sauron, who created these rings. And the way Peter Jackson does in the films is brilliant too, that when a character like Frodo puts on the ring, all of reality around him becomes distorted. It's kind of wavy and blurry. However, he's able to see with clarity evil things. He's able to see the Nazgul and these dark kingly figures in much more clarity than he is without the ring. And so it's a key hint at what the ring of power does to you. And the ring of power can just symbolize power with a capital P, that it tends to corrupt your own identity. It tends to blur reality around you. And it brings you under the control of powers that you perhaps weren't expecting to give allegiance to.
And this is very typical of how Satan and evil works in general. Satan is a master of illusion. And what he always tries to do in our spiritual lives is highlight, bring into focus the evil at the cost of the beauty. Because in the end, evil is actually much smaller than good, and it's much weaker than good. But if it's all that you see, if the enemy is able to put blinders on us and make us hyper-focus on the evil, it seems quite terrifying and powerful. And you see that when someone puts on the ring, is that you're right. They come under this influence of they're no longer able to see, first of all, foremost, the goodness of their own being, but also the goodness of the world around them. And this now makes them hyper-focused on evil, which distracts them from their ultimate vocation, from their ultimate call.
One thing that I didn't pick up on my first couple times reading through Lord of the Rings, but that I only realized after reading this book, it's called The Battle for Middle Earth by Fleming Rutledge. I'm going to mention several books by the end of this episode here from my Tolkien library, but Fleming Rutledge points out the pervasiveness of, you could describe it as a passive voice in the background of Lord of the Rings. And let me give you an example, which will probably clarify it more. There's a key scene near the beginning where Gandalf is explaining to Frodo the significance of the evil ring and the significance of it being discovered by Bilbo. You know, Bilbo is Frodo's uncle. He's just this simple hobbit, this country bumpkin. Frodo's wondering, like, why Bilbo? Like, how, of all the people in Middle Earth, why this little hobbit? How did he end up with the ring? And here's what Gandalf says. There was something else at work beyond any design of the ringmaker. I can put it no plainer than by saying that Bilbo was meant to find the ring and not by its maker, in which case you were also meant to have it. And that may be an encouraging thought. There's several scenes like this throughout the books where usually Gandalf, but sometimes other figures will reference almost as an allusion to fate or destiny, but it's not merely passive. It's like there's this active agent kind of working behind the scenes, pulling a few strings here and there to
providence.
Yeah, basically. That's what I'm trying to drive at is Tolkien, I think this is what makes his work so brilliantly Catholic is the whole story is saturated with providence, but he never mentions the name of God.
Absolutely. There's the brilliance that we allude to. I call it Catholic genius. And genius in the traditional sense of being this diffusive kind of ability to transmit the truth. The Catholic genius of Tolkien is you're in the background, you'll constantly have these themes going on. You're right. Providence is actually one of the most important themes that's not mentioned explicitly in the book, but definitely is in the background the entire time. The fact that everything that's happening is being guided by a love, is being guided by a hand, not in a dictator kind of way, not in this way that is not respectful of the freedom of the individual characters, but overall, there's an essential goodness to reality that's guiding all things, which Sauron cannot put his claws around. And that's something that inspires also another great theme in Lord of the Rings, which is hope, one of the most fundamental virtues of all.
Yeah, let's go there. Let's talk a little bit about hope. Say more about that.
Yeah, so throughout all of Lord of the Rings, you have, again, this highlight of power, mainly in the person of Sauron. We could go back to the Silmarillion as well and speak about Melkor and all of his legions, the Balrog, and these sort of creatures that come out of it. But overall, in the Lord of the Rings, in the Third Age, you have Sauron as the symbol of despair, which often he brings to being, as it's said by Gandalf, wherever he goes, he brings despair, this kind of hatred, this fear, this anxiety. This is what he takes away. Even Mordor is described as this land of ash, that with this noxious gas that you can't even breathe through. It's just a place that's overbearing and causes this kind of depression upon the soul. At times, that evil seems insurmountable. And that's true in all of our lives. At times, evil seems insurmountable. Can I possibly get to the next day? Can I possibly move forward in my life? But one of the most powerful scenes, in my opinion, both in the book as well as in the movies, is at the end of The Two Towers, when you have this beautiful monologue from Sam. And Sam will speak about the fact that hope in the end is what distinguishes us from the enemy. The fact that the enemy tries to make us fall into despair, the enemy tries to take away any cause for our being, and yet there's something within us that is hope-filled because we know that this is a good world and it's worth fighting for. That is a fundamentally Christian sentiment. This world, no matter how much evil happens in it, it is good and it is worth fighting for. I quote those words of Samwise quite frequently in homilies, as well as when I'm giving lectures or teaching at conventions.
I love that scene. There's another similar one where Gandalf is talking with Frodo. In fact, I have a poster of it right behind my desk here, so I see it every day. And Frodo says to Gandalf, "I wish it need not have happened in my time," said Frodo. And he's talking about this destruction, this shadow of Mordor, this, you know, it seems like the goodness of the world is about to be swamped and overtaken. And Gandalf says, "So do I," said Gandalf, "and so do all who live to see such times. But that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us." It ties into that same theme of hope. And it reminds me, getting back to last week's episode with G.K. Chesterton, The Ballad of the White Horse, that theme is on display in that poem as well, that Alfred and the Saxons are fighting this insurmountable war against the invading Vikings. And he receives a vision of Our Lady, who essentially encourages him to have hope even when it seems like it's impossible. Even if you knew you were going to lose, could you still have hope and fight anyway? And I think that same theme permeates Lord of the Rings.
Yes, very much so. And again, that's a fundamentally Christian theme, to find hope in all things and to be dauntlessly optimistic about the triumph of good over evil.
Let's talk about another major theme, and it is the sacramentality of Middle Earth. And I want to be very specific. I don't just mean that it contains the sacraments, although in just a couple of minutes, I want to talk about how some of the sacraments are sort of featured or in some, you know, hazy way present in Middle Earth. But by sacramentality, I mean that everything in the world is not just dumb in the sense of being mute. That everything in the world, from trees to birds towards actions and behaviors, everything is drenched with significance. Trees aren't just ordinary trees. Beams of light are more than just photons. Maybe they're conveyors of help, as we just talked about. Shadows, mountains, they all speak something about reality. It seems so obvious to me that Tolkien gets this sacramentality of the world through his Catholicism. I think that's maybe the most evident way in which his Catholicism shines through. You read a lot of the 20th century historians, I'm thinking of H.G. Wells and a lot of Marxist historians, who present history as sort of just dumbly progressing along to this pinnacle that we've now reached, but it's not directed by anything. It's not guided by anything. It doesn't mean anything. It just is. Like, you know, people are born, they live, they die, civilizations arise, they flourish, they die, but history doesn't mean anything. Reality doesn't mean anything. But that's not for Tolkien the Catholic at all how he viewed his Middle Earth. Everything has significance and meaning.
Yeah, what we're alluding to is one of the greatest fallouts of the scientific, industrial, and technological revolutions. The fact that there was a fundamental change in how humanity now views the created world after these events. This is not to speak against the goodness of science, but it is to say that science does not explain the whole of reality completely and sufficiently. And the Industrial Revolution and the technological revolutions have done even worse to heighten this tendency within modernity and postmodernity to say that the world is a dead, inert object. It's just a collection of atoms, atomic structures, that with my intellect and rationality, I can manipulate for my own will and volition. Well, if that's the world, it's a very cold, dead place. Yet before the scientific, industrial, and technological revolutions, the way that Catholics saw the world, so we had a fundamentally Christian ethos in society, this is what we called Christendom, we understood the world as sacrament, meaning the world spoke to a reality higher than itself. And as you mentioned, everything in reality speaks to the beauty of its creator and becomes a sign and a symbol of each other. It's interacting with one another. The Native Americans, for example, received this with joyous love when they received the gospel in the New World. This is why Native Americans had such an easy time converting to Catholicism. And it wasn't through forced conversions and all these sort of, you know, mentalities that we hear. That was not what happened en masse with the Native Americans, as we know from our histories. Rather, the Native Americans had this natural inclination to Catholicism because of the sacramentality of Catholicism, because they too, in their own spirituality, understood the world means something at its very depths. And then when they learn about Christ, they're like, oh my goodness, yes, this is what it means. All of reality is pointing towards a lover that seeks me and towards a greater good to which I'm called. You see this in Tolkien's world, that he rehabilitates within our own imaginations the notion of sacramental reality, sacramental eyesight, which all Catholics are supposed to have.
Another thing I learned later after reading Lord of the Rings for the first time, if you finish The Return of the King, which is the third volume in the book, there's a whole set of appendices, like hundreds of pages of appendices. And that's only the beginning of the whole historical background of Middle Earth. Like, there's now, I think, close to 10 volumes encompassing the history of Middle Earth. But in some of those historical places, you'll find dates on which significant events in Middle Earth occurred. And I think this date might actually be in the Lord of the Rings story. And I just passed over it the first time, but the ring was destroyed in Mount Doom on March 25th. And it seems weird just to have that date. I think there's only one or two other dates in the books. There's like, I think the date on which they set out from the Shire on the beginning of their journey, and then maybe a couple more along the way. But Tolkien was emphatic about that date, that the ring was destroyed on March 25th. Now, if you're a Catholic reading that, and maybe you need to open up your liturgical calendar if you don't have all the dates memorized, but that one should immediately jump out at you as the Feast of the Annunciation. So this is when the angel Gabriel tells Mary that she's going to conceive Christ. And, you know, as Catholics, or just as humans, we know that life begins at conception, right? So the incarnation, although we celebrate it at Christmas, the incarnation really took place on March 25th. So the entrance of Christ into the world took place March 25th, 9 months before Christmas. And then I didn't learn this till reading some other commentaries, that there is a long tradition stretching back to the patristic time of this date being significant throughout salvation history. Now, again, I don't know if there's historical or calendar basis for this, but the ways that the ancients used to read salvation history, that this particular date was also the traditional date of Christ's crucifixion and death. So he was conceived on this day, he died on this day. It was also the date of the creation of Adam, the date of the fall of Lucifer, the date of the passing of Israel through the Red Sea, and again, the date of the destruction of the ring. So what Tolkien is trying to signify here is that the destruction of this ring of power is also the same date through which the Savior of the world is born, through which all of death, destruction, evil is finally defeated, not just in the historical sense, but in the cosmic sense as well.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. See, I did not know that till you just mentioned it. That's pretty powerful. That's also the day that this podcast started, March 25th, which we did intentionally for Our Lady, for the Annunciation. We consecrated this podcast to Our Lady in the Annunciation. But it's really, really beautiful to learn that. And you could see, yet again, Tolkien's Catholic background, his Catholic genius, understanding that it is the Annunciation, is the incarnation of Christ that conquers all evil.
Speaking of Our Lady, let's talk about depictions of Our Lady in Lord of the Rings. This is also another fun one that if you're a Catholic reading or watching the Lord of the Rings, you'll recognize at least one Marian figure very clearly. And I'm thinking here of Galadriel. She's the elven queen of Lothlorien, one of the most beautiful, entrancing figures in the whole legendarium. Tolkien said in one of his letters, "I think it is true that I owe much of this character, Galadriel, to Christian and Catholic teaching and imagination about Mary." And he later remarked that it is upon Our Lady that all my own small perception of beauty, both in majesty and simplicity, is founded. It's quite a profound thing to say that all of his perception of beauty and majesty, these are two features that explode throughout his work, beauty and majesty, are founded on Our Lady. I'm curious, you were already Catholic when you read Lord of the Rings, when you first encountered Galadriel, did you recognize Mary at all in her?
Immediately, especially being a Hispanic Catholic. So my mother's of Hispanic background. For us in our culture, Our Lady is the pinnacle of that holiness. And we're raised constantly with an awareness of the Blessed Mother and her tender motherly care being part of our lives. So when I read Galadriel, I immediately recognized in her the virtues of Our Lady, especially this tender accompaniment, this sense of, but also a firmness. Galadriel is not a pushover. I mean, she's very much sometimes also firm and pushing even onward the fellowship towards their mission. So I immediately did recognize Our Lady and some themes about her in Galadriel. And you could see that being this wonderful gift of Catholicism of recognizing femininity and its unique role in salvation, its unique role in the advancement of goodness and triumph of over evil through Our Lady, and Tolkien then incorporates that into his legendarium.
There's another Marian figure kind of hovering in the background throughout Lord of the Rings. Her name is Elbereth. You'll find more about her in the Silmarillion, but you'll see her name, you'll hear her name mentioned several times in Lord of the Rings without much explanation of who this woman is. But Frodo calls out to her almost as a prayer when he's attacked by the Nazgul at Weathertop. And then the first time he uses this phial of Galadriel, Galadriel gives him this special potion in a phial, and it gives off light and goodness. And he's being attacked by the big spider Shelob and puts forward the phial of Galadriel and again invokes Elbereth, her name, as a sort of a prayer. Aragorn refers to Elbereth's name as deadly to the Nazgul, that even speaking the name wards off the Nazgul. So think here as a Catholic of the power of the name of Mary and Our Lady. But then I think the most beautiful scene, and maybe the most Marian scene of the whole series, it's early in the book. Frodo and Sam encounter the elves. I think they're walking through the woods and they're singing a hymn to Elbereth. Let me just read you a few lines of that and tell me if you can't recognize the Blessed Mother in these lines. "Snow white, snow white, O lady clear, O queen beyond the western seas, O light to us that wander here amid the world of woven trees. O Elbereth, Githaniel, we still remember, we who dwell in this far land beneath the trees, thy starlight on the western seas." I mean, you can't miss the Marian Regina, overtones.
Exactly. Misericordia. The first time I read that, I immediately thought of we who in this valley of tears are longing out for you, Our Lady. I mean, this is most certainly an allusion to the Salve Regina.
And Our Lady, Star of the Sea. You've got these references to the ocean and to the west and to be over the sea. So again, I think this was one of the cases where Tolkien maybe let his Catholicism slip a little too clearly into the story, because it's very close, almost to the point of being allegorical toward Mary. All right, how about another question here? A lot of people, again, hear that Lord of the Rings is a Catholic work. It has Catholic themes. And the first question they ask is, okay, where's Christ? Who's the Christ figure in Lord of the Rings? And they're probably thinking of, you know, in the Chronicles of Narnia, Aslan is clearly the Christ figure. In the Harry Potter series, Harry Potter, although not fully a Christ allegory, is very clearly the full list, you know, depiction of Christ. Where do we see Christ in the Lord of the Rings, do you think?
Everyone. And this is very Catholic as well. So, of course, I mean, you could look at Frodo and his priestly character, so his sacrificial character going up Mount Doom in the Land of Mordor. You can look most certainly at Gandalf and him being this prophetic voice, and you could look at Aragorn being this kingly voice. But I think that one of the uniquely Catholic aspects also of Tolkien's work is that at some point in the story, all of them become a Christ figure, meaning they all are take up that mantle of virtue, meaning the heroes all take up that mantle of virtue and sacrifice, even going down to Merry and Pippin. At some point or another, they are quite heroic in their sacrificial love, and that's true through our baptism. I know we are going to hone in on three characters here in a minute with Frodo, Gandalf, and Aragorn, but I did just want to make the point that you can look at all these characters, just like each of us are baptized and Christ is alive in us, and through their unique personality, they do manifest this Christ-like attitude of service and sacrifice. There's sometimes when they fail, sometimes when they fall short, but in the moments of virtue, they all really do take on this Christ-like mentality, this Christ-like figureship. But three in particular sort of stand out. Do you want to focus in on those for a second, Brandon?
Yeah, we'll walk through them one at a time. But before we get to that, I just wanted to piggyback on what you just said, that it strikes me one of the major themes of Vatican II was the universal call to holiness, that we're all in some way participating in the fullness of Christ's identity. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, it specifically says in one of the Vatican II documents that just as Christ bears this threefold office, priest, prophet, king, many past encyclicals and councils have emphasized that all priests share in that threefold task, priest, prophet, king. But what Vatican II introduced, I hesitate to say that because it's there latent in the whole tradition, but they articulated it that all the laity are also supposed to share in this threefold office, that the laity are supposed to manifest the priestliness of Christ, the prophetic nature of Christ, the kingly nature of Christ. And so in some ways, Tolkien is anticipating Vatican II. He wrote these books shortly before the Second Vatican Council. Maybe there's like a doctoral dissertation for somebody, like J.R. Tolkien and Vatican II in conversation.
Who knows? By this point, when Tolkien's writing his work, there would be several lay movements that are rising up with this notion behind it very emphatically, most, of course, prominent of which is Opus Dei. In the beginnings of that movement before the Second Vatican Council was concluded. But yes, this is a theme that is rising up and being revived in Catholicism in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, mainly due to the rediscovery of patristic text in the past two centuries of Catholicism, because this is a very ancient notion that all laity are called to universal holiness, and also that through baptism we share in this threefold office of Christ.
So let's walk through these three main characters, Frodo, Gandalf, and Aragorn, because again, I think it's a masterstroke of Tolkien's that he doesn't have just one Christ figure that's an allegorical representation of Jesus, but instead he sort of refracts the light of Christ in various characters. And you kind of listed out how most people see it, Father Blake, that Frodo is kind of the priestly character, Gandalf is the prophetic character, and Aragorn is the kingly character. I've seen other people apply the framework of the Trinity on those three people. I've seen other people do mind, soul, and heart on those three characters. But let's stick with the priest, prophet, and king. I'd like to raise one of the features of Frodo, that as priest, he obviously is making a great sacrifice. He's carrying this ring of of power under great duress across basically all of Middle Earth to destroy it when every evil creature and force on Middle Earth is bent against him. But one interesting comparison is to see that in light of Christ's Via Dolorosa, Christ's own carrying of the cross, the way of sorrows. Just as the crucifixion accounts are at the very heart of the Gospels, this Via Dolorosa of Frodo is basically the fundamental thread of the Lord of the Rings. It kind of, this priestly, in this priestly dimension, we see the carrying of the cross as like the bedrock of the narrative arc.
Yes. And you see also in Frodo the true contradiction to the artificial sense of power that Sauron has. And this is very reminiscent of Christ. When Christ carries the cross, he carries upon his shoulders the false suppositions of man for what power is: domination, hatred, violence. And he now shows the true source of power: humility, mercy, and love. And this is something that all the powers of evil cannot even stand against at all by the shedding of Christ's blood. Frodo does the same thing. What does the ring symbolize? All the artifices of perverted power, violence, despair, hopelessness. And what does Frodo, a little hobbit, and that's just so brilliant of Tolkien to have these creatures, which are, by the way, these creatures are entirely from Tolkien's legendarium. Hobbits have not existed before that. They are creatures of his own heart and imagination, and they're his favorite of creatures as well. He mentioned them and the elves, of course. Tolkien also loved elves. But this understanding that it's the littlest, smallest of creatures, the most pathetic in the eyes of Sauron, who through his humility and love is able to conquer the might of Mordor, that is profoundly Christian and beautifully Catholic in its foundations.
Yeah, whenever I think of that, I think of Therese and the little way. It's these small things with great love that ultimately explode the evil of Mordor. And it reminds me, too, of C.S. Lewis, Tolkien's friend, in Mere Christianity. He describes the incarnation of Christ as this great kingly conqueror coming clandestinely behind enemy lines in the form of a baby. Satan never expected Christ because he came in such a humble and innocent form. And in some ways, that's mirrored in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, that Frodo literally walks right through the gates and right up the mountain in the front door, literally under Sauron's eye. Like he's right beneath his eye to destroy the ring, but Sauron never sees him because he thinks the only way I could ever be defeated is by some great warrior, some great army. He's thinking in political and military terms. He never expects this small, humble, innocent savior. And that has so many overtones for the incarnation itself.
Yes, very much so.
Okay, let's look briefly also at Gandalf. Now, many people think Gandalf is the priestly character. He looks like a priest. He's got these big flowing gray robes and then eventually white robes. And he's got a priestly wisdom and sagacity to himself. But you might say that Gandalf is the prophet because he's always revealing hidden knowledge. He's speaking the truth of God or Iluvatar. He's working wonders. He's teaching others the way and leading them on the way. He's more of like a John the Baptist or an Isaiah or a Jonah. He's a prophet crying out into the wilderness against the evils of his day. Do you see that in Gandalf as well?
Yes, absolutely. You see it in a special way in the interaction between him and Saruman. So Saruman is supposed to be this all-wise wizard. Of course, he's the head of the council and the great white wizard of wisdom. But yet he abandons wisdom for madness in his search for power. And who's there to speak against that? Gandalf. Gandalf looks him straight in the eye. As a brother wizard, remember that they both had these similar origins. They were sent into Middle Earth and entrusted with the same mission to help guide men, to help guide these creatures to freedom. And Saruman decides to use this opportunity, this vocation, for his own devices, which ultimately leads to his destruction. And also, he loses that authority and that power, which is handed over to Gandalf because of his prophetic office. So you see Gandalf speaking against Saruman, speaking against the evil of Sauron, and even the power of language itself. The scene whenever he helps exorcise, if you will, Theoden, the king of Rohan, and to liberate him. The power of Gandalf's voice and speaking truth and purity is what ultimately sets people free and guides them and helps them to accomplish the tasks to which they've been entrusted.
So we have Frodo the priest, Gandalf the prophet, and then the most clearest association, probably Aragorn the king. You know, the third volume is titled The Return of the King, and it's referring to Aragorn. Aragorn is this exiled king of Gondor who's kind of hovering in the woods and protecting the hobbits in the Shire, but he's been exiled from his proper kingdom of Gondor. Gondor is led for most of the story just by stewards or placeholders of it. And so a big part of the story is how Aragorn is coming back to claim the throne that is rightfully his. But man, it's so redolent of Christ the King, because throughout the Gospels, you have this Savior who is the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, but he doesn't immediately come into his kingdom, to use biblical language. He doesn't immediately take his throne. In fact, he's constantly telling people, don't, you know, my time's not ready. Don't tell people who I am. He's almost deflective of his kingship. And we see that same thing with Aragorn. He is reticent until the time is right, until the fullness of time, if we want to use more biblical language, to become the rightful king. And then one more other beautiful scene. I love this part of Lord of the Rings. It's in the third book where he finally makes his way into Gondor, again, the kingdom that's rightfully his, but still not proclaiming himself as king. And there's some sick people that have been injured in the battlefield, and he goes into this healing house and asks how they're doing, if there's anything they can do. And then one of the attendants mentions that there was this legend, this prophecy, if you will, of Gondor, that the hands, let me see, I want to get this right, the hands of the king are the hands of a healer, and so the rightful king be known. The hands of the king are the hands of a healer, and so the rightful king shall be known. And so it's by healing that his identity is revealed. And of course, Aragorn is able to heal some of these major characters, and that's what exposes him as the true king. And if you're a Christian reading this, you can't help but immediately think of Christ the King, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you also see Aragorn's sort of dominion, if you will, over not just the living, but the dead. So think about this dead army that he summons up in order to help fight in the battle for Gondor, but also by releasing them. He releases them of their oath because they had failed in the previous battle. Now this is a way for them to redeem their honor. And this is a way of him as king letting them know through the blood that goes in his veins, because even the king of the dead says, you know, that bloodline has been spent. And he says, no, that blood is in my veins. Mm. It's the blood of this king that gives him the authority over not just earth, but even the dead. This, of course, correlates to Christ, who is king of heaven and earth, and even has authority over death itself, the harrowing of hell, that ancient teaching that we see in the church that happens on Holy Saturday night. So you even see a connection there on that theological level between Aragorn and Christ the King.
You know, the reading and the Liturgy of the Hours on Holy Saturday, it's always that ancient
sermon.
One of my favorites.
Yeah, I know
you and I both love that. And it's like the same speech that Aragorn gives when he's going into to rally the dead. He's saying like, awake, arise, I'm here to liberate you, I'm here to free you, I'm here to bring you life. So again, with the Christological imagination, you can't help but read Aragorn and see Christ all over the place. I'm finally taking my first glance at the clock. We're at like an hour and 7 minutes, which probably it's probably pretty good for us. I got maybe two or three more things I wanted to kick around with you. So a lot of people, when I talk with them about Lord of the Rings, say, where's Christ? We've talked a little bit about that. They'll also say, if this is a Catholic book, where are the sacraments? How come the sacraments don't show up? How would you begin to answer that?
The same way that we have previously, insofar as the sacraments don't need to be explicitly mentioned to be present. So we know that throughout this series in The Lord of the Rings, there'll be multiple allusions to these different sacraments. We think, of course, of the Eucharist itself. So the fact that that you're receiving nourishment along your journey to reach your ultimate cause, they're given the limbus bread, we know, by the elves. And they refer to this actually on multiple occasions. It's not like, oh, they were given this sort of biscuit and then Tolkien never mentions it again. I was amazed the first time I read through the books. And even in the movies, they did a good job about this, of how key Limbus Bread is for them finishing their journey. They're constantly referring to, we have to eat this, we have to devour this. And even at one point, we know there's a sabotage of that between Smeagol and Samwise. So that is already an allusion to this bread, this food that we need for the journey.
Yeah, here's a quote that I wanted to read about the Limbus. So they describe the Limbus as having a virtue without which Frodo and Sam would long ago have lain down to die. It did not satisfy desire, so it wasn't like tasty, it wasn't delicious. And at times, Sam's mind was filled with the memories of food and longing for simple bread and meats. And yet, this whey bread of the elves, and by the way, that term is used often to describe the Limbus, whey bread. I think Tolkien also uses the word host at one point to describe it. So you got the Eucharistic language all over the place. But he says, and yet this whey bread of the elves had a potency that increased as travelers relied on it alone and did not mingle it with other foods. It fed the will, and it gave strength to endure and to master sinew and limb beyond the measure of mortal kind. So you have this heavenly food that doesn't really taste good, and that doesn't, it sort of satisfies your bodily needs, but more important, it gives you the power of the will and the power of endurance to carry on the mission you've been given. Eucharist, Eucharist, Eucharist.
Yep. I mean, it couldn't be more plain than that.
We also see a couple of other ones that are less obvious. The Eucharist is the main sacramental allusion in the books, but there's also anointing of the sick in a form and confession in a form. So anointing of the sick, I mentioned earlier, the hands of the king are the hands of a healer, and so the rightful king shall be known. And so you have, you know, Aragorn, this kingly figure who also manifests dimensions of the priestly and prophetic, healing people and bringing them back to life through his hands. And the way Tolkien describes it, he doesn't say like he traced a cross on their foreheads, but it's always like he placed their hands on their brow or on their, you can't think of Jesus healing people that way, or priests, you know, healing people through anointing.
Yeah, when I anoint people, I don't make the sign of the cross on their forehead. I mean, I lay hands on them first. And then afterwards, you make the sign of the cross on their forehead and their hands. But first, you have this laying on of hands, which takes place. And then, of course, we have this last aspect, which, you know, we've mentioned and spoken about previously in our conversations at Boroughshire, but the sacrament of reconciliation, confession. We know that Boromir, who, again, is a very tragic character in some ways, and I say tragic in the traditional sense, to where his story is sad, but there's redemption, there's beauty at the end of it. We know that he at one point succumbs to temptation of the ring, and that is ultimately what leads him to even push Frodo away. But at the end of his life, he's not overcome by greed. He's not overcome by the lust for power, this desire, this misplaced desire to save. He actually sacrifices his life to save the other hobbits. And before his death, he has this beautiful encounter with Aragorn, who's the king. So we see there, again, the Christ figure interacting here with this sinner figure, and confesses what he did. He could have just said, you know, I'm going to die now. You're my brother. Thank you for everything. You're my true king. But I love the fact that he tells Aragorn what he did first and then declares Aragorn as king. I would have followed you to the end. There's this wonderful correlation between that interaction and the sacrament of reconciliation, to where we confess our sins to the priest. Here's what I did. And then through that confession, we are rehabilitated in relationship with the King of Kings, who is Christ Jesus the Lord.
So beautifully put. Well, let's close with this Catholic theme in Lord of the Rings, and it might be the arch theme, the leitmotif of the whole thing, and that's the eventual victory of goodness and beauty over evil and darkness, that whatever tragedies and horrors be visited on the world, no matter how deep and profound and extensive they seem, they won't have the final word. That seems to be the major theme of Lord of the Rings. And I got one more quote that I want to read here. It's one of the most beautiful lines from the Lord of the Rings. In fact, I have another frame in my office here with this one on it. This one is from Sam. Sam and Frodo are creeping through the dark, smoky, shadowy Mordor barren landscape, surrounded by stench and death, and it's the most hopeless place you could imagine to be. And here's what happens and how Sam responds. There, peeping among the cloud rack above a dark tor high up in the mountains, Sam saw a white star twinkle just for a while. The beauty of it smote his heart as he looked up out of that forsaken land, and hope returned to him. For, like a shaft, clear and cold, the thought pierced him that in the end, the shadow was only a small and passing thing. There was light and beauty forever beyond its reach. Tolkien is such a gifted writer in terms of capturing beauty, but that, to me, is the synopsis of the whole theme of Lord of the Rings. The shadow was only a small and passing thing. There was a light and high beauty forever beyond its reach.
And that is true for each and every one of us, my brothers and sisters. That is true for us. The shadow of evil, of violence, hatred, war, selfishness, lust, greed, envy, sloth, all these devices which the enemy tries to convince us are stronger than ourselves and stronger than Christ and the church, they are passing shadows. They're nothing. They're nothing compared to the divine mercy and the grandeur of the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And we need that kind of hope to be entrenched within our bones. And that's what Tolkien does so wonderfully through his work, is that he really is an evangelist in that sense. A creative, imaginative evangelist who preaches the gospel of hope to a world that's broken down in darkness and is sometimes loses sight of the stars that are above us and the bright light of Christ's mercy. So for us, as we close up this reflection on Tolkien and just the incredible genius that he is, not just in his literary capacity, but also in his creative capacity, we thank him and we thank the Lord for creating him to be a messenger of hope, a messenger of joy, of the truth of the gospel, that Jesus Christ is King, and that there is nothing in this world that can change that fact, no matter how powerful it may seem. And there's always a ray of light that will pierce through the darkness and eventually conquer it.
I know a lot of people describe Tolkien as an evangelist. In fact, we have an article at Word on Fire. I'll link to it here in the show notes, but it's by our friend Frederick Heidemann. The article is titled, "I Was an Atheist Until I Read Lord of the Rings." And he explains how Lord of the Rings led him to God and then to Catholicism. And I think Tolkien has done the work of pre-evangelization for millions of people. Again, he's not pronouncing the name of Christ. He's not explicitly proposing the gospel, but he's laying the foundation on which the gospel can be built. I think of the fathers used to speak of like preparation for evangelization. I forgot the Latin that they would have used, like
the proto-evangelium.
Yeah, no, that's like the Genesis, the original thing. But anyway, they're, you know, like, it's a paving the way. It's like the John the Baptist work. You know, I'm clearing out the path. I'm making a clear way for Christ to come. To me, that's what Tolkien is the master at. Maybe over the last 500 years, is I don't think anybody has taken the Catholic imagination, put it into such an entrancing, attractive form, shared it with hundreds of millions of people. And although his intention wasn't to explicitly evangelize, that's what's happening. That's what's happening in the background of this story, is the sacramental Catholicism is just being injected unsuspectingly to a lot of people. And it's just a gift that I think for generations to come, we'll still be seeing the fruit of that.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, so let's wrap up this prologama of Tolkien and Lord of the Rings. We're going to have another 15-part series of Lord of the Rings coming up soon, I'm sure. But I grabbed a handful of my favorite Tolkien books off of my shelves. I've got maybe three or four bookcases of Tolkien books. And that's one of the funnest things to do as a Catholic, is just to first read Lord of the Rings, get into it, love it as a story, but then read some secondary literature on it, unpacking the spiritual, religious themes, and then go back and reread Lord of the Rings. And it just continues to unfold like a flower. So I'd encourage you, whether you've read Lord of the Rings or not, pick up one of these secondary books and then go back and give it another chance. So these are some of my favorites. I don't know if you've read any of these, Father Blake, but the first one's by Joseph Pierce. I know you know Joseph Pierce and have read his stuff. He's one of the great interpreters of Lewis and Tolkien and Chesterton. This one's called Frodo's Journey, Discovering the Hidden Meaning of the Lord of the Rings. Probably it's short. You see how thin it is. Probably the best Catholic book highlighting the Catholic symbolism of Lord of the Rings. Next one called The Power of the Ring, The Spiritual Vision Behind the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit by the late Stratford Caldecott. Listen to this endorsement from Peter Kraft. If anyone asks me what one book about Tolkien is the one most worth reading, The Power of the Ring is my reply. So I've read chunks of this. It's quite good. It's basically a series of essays on the Lord of the Rings. Recommend it. Speaking of Peter Kraft, The Philosophy of Tolkien, The Worldview Behind the Lord of the Rings. And in this book, he's looking at philosophical questions that Lord of the Rings raises. So good versus evil, free will, philosophy of beauty, things like that. So if you have a highly intellectual philosophical mind, check that one out. Bradley Berzer's book, Sanctifying Myth, or J.R.R. Tolkien's Sanctifying Myth, kind of part biographical, but part overview of the whole legendarium. And then finally, this is the one I recommend as my favorite book on Lord of the Rings. It's an older book. It's titled The Battle for Middle-earth, Tolkien's Divine Design in the Lord of the Rings. It's written by Fleming Rutledge. Fleming is an Anglican woman theologian. And this book, why I found it so enticing, is it's essentially a passage-by-passage commentary on Lord of the Rings. Not quite line-by-line. You need probably 10,000 pages for that. But it's like if you're reading the Bible and you want a good Bible commentary, that's what this is for Lord of the Rings. So you want to read this like alongside the Lord of the Rings. And man, does it open up so many new dimensions of the story. So those are my favorite books. Any other recommended thoughts or links or resources or anything, Father Blake?
I think Fleming Rutledge also did a lecture, did she not, on the priest, prophet, king aspect of Lord of the Rings? Or am I thinking of another text?
Yeah, certainly.
It's a little
be.
Small. It's a small green book, and I should have brought it with me now that I'm thinking about it. But it's a wonderful text, and it's actually a lecture which was given in England on the priest, prophet, king aspects of Lord of the Rings. It's fantastic. So if nice. I find it, I'll definitely give it to you, and we could share it in the show notes. Yeah, but other than that, I would just say to our listeners, if you have not read The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, please do so. You know, I definitely need to read The Hobbit first, in my opinion. I think that's worth going to and reading through that delightful, delightful book. Again, when I initially picked it up, you know, in fourth and fifth grade, I couldn't really get into it. But once I reread it as an adult, I thought, my goodness, what a well-written story. And I thought, my gosh, this was a kid's story back in his time. You know, how far below our literature has gone. So just reading The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings is my suggestion, you know, along with this podcast. I think that will give you a good footing into the world of Tolkien. And then those other texts that you mentioned, especially one by Joseph Pierce, is quite wonderful.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think The Hobbit's a good entry point. It's written at a lower level, so it's more accessible. Mm-hmm. Again, you said it was a kid's book. I remember the same experience. I'm like, oh, it's a kid's book. It's going to be, you know, breezy. And you read it, and you're like, gosh, this is like at a college level. Like, if that was kids' books back in the 40s or whenever it was, yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Well, thanks so much for listening to this episode. If we inspired you to read Lord of the Rings, then we accomplished our goal. if you've already read it and we helped you to see some of the Catholic themes, then we're even happier about that. Again, I'll link all the books I mentioned, and I got some other extra links that I'm going to pop in there as well, including I'll link to a photo log of our England pilgrimage that Father Blake and I were on, because we took some good photos inside of Tolkien's church and all of that. And we also included addresses of all the Tolkien places, including his grave, which we got to visit. It was very moving. So if you ever go to England or find yourself there and want to visit these sites, you'll know where to find them. So thanks.
Yeah, by far one of the best trips I've ever had in my life. And on that note, I think it's worth mentioning that we did lose a giant in the literary world as far as recently, Walter Hooper. And although he himself never really wrote as much as Lewis or as much as Tolkien, he most certainly was part of that group. And so we keep him in our prayers. For those who don't know who he is, he was C.S. Lewis's secretary for quite some time, and himself actually a very accomplished writer. I mean, he wrote very, very well. But he just passed away recently, and Brandon and I had the privilege of having afternoon tea with him when we were in England. And just such a kind, delightful, and Catholic soul. I mean, really, who deeply admired Tolkien, you know, who knew him and also deeply admired Lewis. So we pray for the repose of his soul and also his family during this podcast.
Amen. Yeah, in the past year, we've lost Christopher Tolkien, who was kind of the great carrier on of J.R.R. Tolkien's legacy, and then Walter Hooper, who carried on Lewis's legacy. It's kind of the end of an era. We did our Benedict XVI podcast. It's like what's going to happen when he passes away. It's like one chapter of history is ending, and a new one must begin.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us on this extended episode of the Burrowshire podcast. It was great being with you all, and we'll see you next time.
Yes, only our true fans will watch the extended edition of the J.R.R. Tolkien podcast. But God bless you all, and see you all next time. Bye.